sex difference in aggressive responses, with women overwhelmingly compelled to retaliate by attacking the offender's reputation, mostly through gossip. This gender effect panned out even after controlling for participants' evaluation of the social appropriateness of such acts. In other words, even though the women realized malicious gossip wasn't socially appropriate, this was nevertheless their preferred first point of attack. Men, on the other hand, were more evenly divided in their responses, but failed to show the same preferential bias for acts of informational warfare against the unlikable classmate. Although most researchers acknowledge the speculative nature of evolutionary arguments in this area, social aggression among reproductively viable females is usually interpreted as a form of mate competition. Hess and Hagen, for example, suggest that the sex differences uncovered in their study would likely have been even more pronounced in a younger group of participants. Evolutionarily, historically, and cross-culturally, they point out, girls in the 15 to 19-year-old range would be most actively competing for mates. Thus, anything that would sabotage another female's image as a desirable reproductive partner, such as commenting on her promiscuity, physical appearance, or some other aberrant or quirky traits, tends to be the stuff of virile gossip. Also, the degree of bitchiness should then demonstrate a sort of bell-shaped curve over the female life course. On the surface, this seems mostly true. Anecdotally, I can't think of a single postmenopausal woman who seems hell-bent on undermining another woman's dating life. Unless, perhaps, that involves spreading rumors about the sexual rival of her fertile daughter, in whom she has a vested adaptive interest. Then I can actually name names. The psychologist Ann Campbell's work on sex differences and aggression has managed to carefully tease apart the many complex strands of cultural transmission and hormonal mediators in female violence. Campbell has argued that much of the sex differences in aggression can be understood in terms of parental investment theory. Parental investment theory was developed in the early 1970s by the biologist Robert Trivers. One of its basic implications is that since human mothers make a disproportionately greater contribution to, and physical investment in, the offspring's survival than human fathers, women have evolved to be generally more reserved than men in mating strategies. Typical male physical violence, Campbell argues, is largely a form of showy sexual competition between men for reproductive access to the most desirable women. The type of social aggression we've just observed in women also appears to be a form of intrasexual competition for the most desirable men, but it avoids the comparatively higher cost of physical harm to women's precariously fertile bodies. No parent wants to think he or she is rearing a socially insensitive daughter. But remember that psychological science is a discipline based on statistically significant aggregate differences between comparison groups. In the present case, there are observed differences in the preferred aggressive retaliatory styles between the sexes, ones that continue to appear even after controlling for social norms. But there's also, of course, fairly dramatic individual variation. The more we understand about the evolved pressures underlying our behaviors, the more we can get a grip on them and evaluate our own motives. One of my favorite thinkers, the feminist cultural constructivist Simone de Beauvoir, wrote famously that one isn't born a woman, but becomes one. While it's true that culture exerts strong pressures shaping expressions of gender disparities, it also helps to know the biological mold that society must contend with. Part 6. The Gayer Science. There's something queer here. Never ask a gay man for directions. I always seem to be the guy people ask for directions. That is to say, me, the spatially challenged, head-to-the-ground, asocial personality trying to avoid eye contact with any given passerby. This was especially the case while I was an expatriate living in Belfast. Usually I tried to wing it so that I didn't come across as completely stupid. But try as I might, my response always ended up sputtering its way into a wan shrug and the trusty fallback, "I'm so sorry, but I'm an American. I'm afraid you've asked the wrong person." Given America's cartoon character status throughout much of Europe, being an apologetically naive Yankee greased my way out of a lot of awkward social encounters in the United Kingdom. So this tactic usually worked just fine, unless I got a chatty person who wasn't in any hurry and I was his or her first live link to the new world. Then I was in for a lengthy discussion about Obama and Disney World. But the truth is, I called Northern Ireland home for almost 6 years, and I should have been able to give directions like a local. It's not as if people were asking me how to get to some little-known footpath in the Mourne Mountains. They wanted to know how to get to the pharmacy or the quickest route to the student union at the university where I worked. It's not just giving directions I struggle with either. For as long as I can remember, I've had a knack for getting lost. I've wasted more of my life wandering around parking lots, hospitals, and campuses than I care to know. Maps? Anathema. I might as well be looking at Mayan hieroglyphics on a tree bark roll. What makes my condition even more ironic is that, according to family legend, I'm descended from the great Danish navigator Vitus Bering. Well, he wasn't all that great, since he got shipwrecked on the Commander Islands and lost nearly half his crew before dying of an unknown disease. But I imagine he would have at least needed to know his way around a nautical map to have been commissioned by Peter the Great and hailed as the first European to spy the southern shores of Alaska. So if I come from such Euclidean-headed genetic stock, why is my own brain slow as molasses when it comes to finding my way around town? According to mounting evidence being gathered by the psychologist Kwasi Rahman and his colleagues, it may well have something to do with the fact that I'm gay. Mind you, it's not that I'm poor at directions because I'm gay, but rather Rahman has discovered a non-trivial neural correlation between these two psychological traits. This correlation is similar in nature to the finding that left-handed individuals demonstrate better memory for events than right-handers due to their generally larger corpora callosa, a neurological boon that facilitates episodic recall. Southpaws are better at recalling memories not because they're left-handed, but because of the common physical or brain denominator underlying the expression of both traits. Due to atypical hormonal influences on the developing fetus during prenatal growth, including the amount of circulating androgens, for example, testosterone, present in the mother's womb, homosexuals, both men and women, often display several telltale biodemographic markers, residual bodily characteristics that indicate the prenatal effect of these hormonal factors. For example, you may already know about the well-publicized 2D4D effect, scientific shorthand for the peculiar finding that for both straight women and gay men, the length ratio between the second and fourth digits, their fingers, is, on average, greater than it is for gay women and straight men. Since the brain is just another physical template, there are also differences between straights and gays in brain structure, notably in the hippocampus, and therefore cognitive abilities. For example, gay men and straight women tend to outperform gay women and straight men on most verbal measures, whereas straight men outperform the other groups on measures of spatial intelligence. In a study reported in Behavioral Neuroscience, Rahman and his colleagues found that gay men are more like women than like straight men, and that they are more dependent on left-right landmark strategies for navigation, for example, turn right at the church, than on the Euclidean orientation strategies preferred by straight men, for example, the bar is 5 miles in an easterly direction. And in a follow-up study in the journal Hippocampus, Rahman and his co-author, the psychologist Joanna Cording, found that heterosexual males are different from gay men, straight women, and gay women in that they perform significantly faster on a task requiring them to scout out novel terrain in order to find a hidden search target. Note that the researchers only tested people who regarded themselves as exclusively heterosexual or homosexual. Bisexuals were excluded. Now, before you go thinking of exceptions to these general findings, you contrarian you, note that they refer to aggregate population level differences. Although I personally match Rahman's cross-sex neurocognitive model for gay brains to a T, my partner Juan's brain is a satellite navigation device that could have given old Uncle Vitus's a run for its money. And Juan, unlike me, has a pronounced 2D4D ratio. Furthermore, in science, a statistically significant difference between comparison groups may actually translate to negligible differences in the real world. Finally, Rahman is quick to point out that it's not as though gay men simply have women's brains, or that gay women have men's brains. Rather, the brains of homosexuals are more like neurocognitive mosaics of both sexes. For example, lesbians do not appear to differ from heterosexual women on cognitive measures except for verbal fluency, where they score in the male typical direction. A final note. I once happened upon a finding indicative of another physiological difference between homosexuals and heterosexuals. In addition to our navigational shortcomings, evidence suggests that gay people produce different armpit odors from straight people, and these scents are detectable. So perhaps if I stopped wearing deodorant, this would deter people from asking me for directions, along with just about anything else. Single angry straight male, seek same. Homophobia as repressed desire. I wish I could say that I decided to come out of the closet in my early 20s for more admirable reasons, such as love or the principle of the thing, but the truth is that passing for a straight person had become more of a hassle than I figured it was worth. Since the third grade, I'd spent too many valuable cognitive resources concocting deceptive schemes to cover up the fact that I was gay. In fact, my earliest conscious tactic to hide my homosexuality involved being outlandishly homophobic. When I was 8 years old, I figured that if I used the word fag a lot, and on every possible occasion expressed my repugnance for gay people, well, others would obviously think I was straight. Although it sounded good in theory, I wasn't very hostile by temperament, and I had trouble channeling my fictitious outrage into convincing practice. I may have failed as a homophobe, but unfortunately many people succeed. And it turns out we may have something in common. Many young homophobic males may secretly harbor homosexual desires. Whether they are consciously trying to deceive the world about them as I was, or are not even aware they exist. One of the most important lines of work in this area dates back to an article published in 1996 in the Journal of Abnormal Psychology, in which the researchers Henry Adams, Lester Wright Jr., and Bethany Lohr report evidence that homophobic young males may secretly have gay urges. In this study, 64 self-reported straight males with a mean age of 20 years were divided into two groups, non-homophobic men and homophobic men, on the basis of their scores on a questionnaire measure of aversion to gay males. Here, homophobia was operationally defined as the degree of dread experienced when placed in close quarters with a homosexual, basically how comfortable or uncomfortable the person was interacting with gay people. There is debate in the clinical literature about the semantics of this term, with some scholars introducing other constructs such as homonegativism to underscore the more cognitive nature of some people's anti-gay stance. Each participant then agreed to attach a penile plethysmograph to his, well, lesser self. This device, which we've met before, is a mercury and rubber circumferential strain gauge used to measure erectile responses to sexual stimuli. When attached, changes in the circumference of the penis cause changes in the electrical resistance of the mercury column. Previous research with this apparatus, the plethysmograph, not the penis, well, actually both, confirmed that significant changes in circumference occur only during sexual stimulation and sleep. Next, the participants were led to a private chamber where they were shown three brief segments of graphic pornography. The three video snippets represented straight porn, scenes of fellatio and vaginal intercourse, lesbian porn, scenes of cunnilingus or tribidism, which is essentially vulva rubbing, and gay male porn, scenes of fellatio and anal intercourse. Following each randomly ordered video presentation, the participant rated how sexually aroused he felt and also his degree of penile erection. Go on, guess the results. Both groups, non-homophobic and homophobic men, showed significant engorgement to the straight and lesbian porn, and their subjective ratings of arousal matched their penile plethysmograph measure for these two types of videos. However, as predicted, only the homophobic men showed a significant increase in penile circumference in response to the gay male porn. Specifically, 26% of these homophobic men showed moderate tumescence, which was 6 to 12 millimeters to this video, and 54% showed definite tumescence, more than 12 millimeters. In contrast, for the non-homophobic men, these percentages were 10 and 24, respectively. Furthermore, the homophobic men significantly underestimated their degree of sexual arousal to the gay male porn. From these data, the researchers concluded that individuals who score high in the homophobic range and admit negative affect toward homosexuality demonstrate significant sexual arousal to male homosexual erotic stimuli. Of course, it isn't clear whether these people are unconsciously self-deceiving or consciously trying to conceal from others their secret attraction to members of the same sex. The Freudian defense mechanism of reaction formation, in which people's repressed desires are manifested by their fervent emotional reactions and hostile behaviors toward the very thing they desire, could explain the former. From Shakespeare's Hamlet, the lady doth protest too much, methinks. The latter implies an act of deliberate social deception, such as my 8-year-old self's misguided scheming. It could, of course, be a bit of both or work differently for different people. Who is to say whether all those inconveniently outed public figures, such as the televangelist Eddie Long and Ted Haggard, the conservative psychiatrist George Reckers, and the politicians Mark Foley and Larry Craig, the very incarnations of this phenomenon, were self-deceiving, or whether they knew they had full-blown homosexual urges all along. Adams and his colleagues' interpretation of these plethysmograph findings have not gone unchallenged. In an article published in the Journal of Research and Personality, the researcher Brian Meyer and his colleagues argue that Adams' findings can be better interpreted as the homophobic group's defensive loathing of gay males rather than a secret attraction. Drawing an analogy to other phobias, they state, "We believe it is inaccurate to argue that spider-phobics secretly desire spiders or that claustrophobics secretly like to be crammed into dark and tight places. These investigators reasoned that Adam's homophobic sample experienced erections in response to the gay male porn due not to their sexual arousal, but to their anxiety over the images, which in turn provoked the physiological response of penile engorgement. In my opinion, however, this defensive loathing reinterpretation by Meyer is a bit off-kilter. Although it is true that ambient anxiety has been shown to increase the degree of sexual arousal in response to stimuli that are already sexually arousing, I could find no evidence that anxiety alone can give a man an erection. At least, I hope this is the case. I get anxious about public speaking. If, on top of everything else, I have to worry about getting an erection during my talks, perhaps I ought to just cancel my appearances. Likewise, by these investigators' logic, male arachnophobes should get a mild tickle down there whenever they spy a spider scurrying across their desk. I suppose that's possible, but it seems rather far-fetched to me. If we take Adam's findings that homophobic men get erections from watching gay porn as reasonable evidence of their sexual arousal, then these findings are enormously important. For example, they may help us to understand some of the psychological causes of gay bashing. Some of the most startling data I've come across involve a 1998 survey of 500 straight men in the San Francisco area. Half of these men said that they had acted aggressive in some way against homosexuals, and these were just the ones who admitted to such acts. And a third of those who hadn't struck out in this manner against gay people said that they would assault or harass a homosexual who made a pass at them. If you miss the irony, this was in San Francisco, presumably one of the most gay-friendly places in the world. In fact, a later study published in the Journal of Abnormal Psychology by Adams and his colleagues found that on a competitive task, homophobic men acted more aggressive toward gay male competitors than they did toward straight male competitors. In this study, 52 self-reported heterosexual men with a mean age of 19 years were again classified as homophobic or non-homophobic based on their responses to various items on a homophobia questionnaire. Participants were then told that they would be exposed to random types of erotic stimuli to determine pornography's effect on response time. In reality, all participants were shown only gay male porn. Before and after watching this 2-minute video of a male couple engaging in sexual foreplay, fellatio, and anal penetration, the participants completed several measures of their current emotional state. For example, whether they felt angry, anxious, sad, and so on. Then they proceeded to the competitive response time task, where on 20 separate trials, they were told to push a button as soon as a red hit light flashed on the console. Participants believed they were competing on this task against another player in an adjacent room. In fact, there was no other player, and the game was rigged so that on a randomly distributed half of the trials, the participant would lose. For every winning round, the participant was told he could deliver an electric shock varying in both degree and intensity to the other, in reality non-existent, player. Alternatively, he had the option of administering no shock at all to this other person. All players lost the first round and experienced a mild electric shock themselves, presumably administered by the other player. The critical manipulation in this study was that half of the participants thought they were competing against a gay male, whereas the other half thought that they were competing against a straight male. Prior to the task, and after watching the gay porn, participants had been shown a brief video introducing them to this other player. In one condition, this fictitious competitor was portrayed as a homosexual with stereotypical affectations who told the interviewer that he was in a, quote, committed gay relationship with his partner Steve for 2 years. In the other condition, this same actor played it straight and said he was involved in a committed dating relationship with his girlfriend for 2 years. Although there was no significant difference between the homophobic and the non-homophobic groups in the intensity and duration of shock administered to the straight competitor on winning trials, the homophobic group delivered more intense shocks and for longer durations when they thought the person in the other room was gay. On the subjective ratings of mood, the major difference between the two groups was on the dimension of anger hostility. Non-homophobic showed a small positive blip in the radar on this dimension, while the homophobic showed a dramatic increase in anger hostility between the pre-video measure of mood and the post-video rating. These data suggest that homoerotic stimuli, such as seeing two men holding hands, could send an already angry homophobic man over the top. Although it is certainly true that the world today is more approving of homosexuality than it was just a decade ago, often begrudgingly so in my opinion, there are still dangerous and malignant social elements beneath the surface preventing real acceptance. The day I can be in a public place in any town USA and simply hold hands with the person I'm in love with, something most couples don't give a second thought to, without placing my partner and me in physical danger, It's the day that I'll be convinced we've moved beyond rhetoric about equal rights and have actually changed hearts and minds. Meanwhile, the next time you come across someone being especially hostile or reproachful toward gay people, stare him in the eye, scratch your chin, and repeat after me. Very interesting. Baby Mama Drama Less Sex: How Gay Heartbreak Reigns on the Polyamory Parade. There's a strange whiff in the air, a sort of polyamory chic, in which liberally minded journalists, an aggregate mass of anti-religious pundits, and even scientists themselves have begun encouraging people to use evolutionary theory to revisit and revise their sexual attitudes, and more important, their behaviors in ways that fit their animal libidos more happily. These recent attempts, including many best-selling books, explore how our modern, God-ridden, puritanical society conflicts with our species' evolutionary design, a tension making us pathologically ashamed of sex. There are, of course, many important caveats, but the basic logic is that because human beings are not naturally monogamous, but rather have been explicitly designed by natural selection to seek out extra-pair copulatory partners, having sex with someone other than your partner or spouse for the replicating sake of one's mindless genes, suppressing these deep mammalian instincts is futile, and worse, an inevitable death knell for an otherwise honest and healthy relationship. Intellectually, I can get on board with this. If you believe, as I do, that we live in a natural rather than a supernatural world, then there is no inherent, divinely inspired reason to be sexually exclusive to one's partner. If you and your partner want to screw your neighbors on Wednesday nights after tacos, participate in beachside orgies lit by bonfires, or slip on your eyeless kidskin discipline helmet and be led along by bridle and bit down the road to your local bondage society's weekly sex fest, then by all means do so and take pictures. But the amoral beauty of Darwinian thinking is that it does not, or at least should not and cannot, prescribe any social behavior, sexual or otherwise, as being the right thing to do. Right is irrelevant. There is only what works and what doesn't work within context and biologically adaptive terms. And so even though any good and proper citizen is an evolutionarily informed sexual libertarian, Charles Darwin provides no more insight into a moral reality than, say, Dr. Laura Schlesinger. On a related note, it's rather strange that we look for moral guidance about human sexuality from the rest of the animal kingdom. A logical fallacy in which what is natural, such as homosexual behavior in other species, is regarded as acceptable. It's as if the fact that bonobos, desert toads, and emus have occasional same-sex liaisons has a moral bearing on gay rights in human beings. Even if we were the lone queer species in this godless galaxy, even if it were entirely a choice between two consenting adults, why would that make it more reasonable to discriminate against people in homosexual relationships? Beyond these philosophical problems with seeking out social prescriptions from a nature that is completely mute as to what we should do with our penises and vaginas, however, there's an even bigger hurdle to taking polyamory chic beyond the tabloids, talk shows, and internet forums and into standard bedroom practice. And that is simply the fact that we've evolved to empathize with other people's suffering, including the suffering of the people we'd betray by putting our affable genitals to their evolved promiscuous use. Heartbreak is every bit as much a psychological adaptation as is the compulsion to have sex with those other than our partners, and it throws a monster of a monkey wrench into the evolutionist otherwise practical polyamory. It's indeed natural for people, especially men, given, unlike women, their essentially unlimited reproductive potential, to seek sexual variety. My partner once likened this to having the same old meal over and over again, for years on end. Eventually, you're going to get some serious cravings for a different dish. But I reminded him that people aren't the equivalent of a plate of spaghetti. Inconveniently enough, we have feelings. Unless you have the unfortunate luck of being coupled with a psychopath, or have the good fortune of being one yourself, broken hearts are not easily experienced at either end, nor are they easily mended by reason or waved away by all the evolutionary logic in the world. And because we're designed by nature not only to be moderately promiscuous, but also to become selfish when that natural promiscuity rears its head, again, naturally, in our partners, reasonable people are far from immune to getting hurt by their partners' open and agreed-upon sex with other parties. Monogamy may not be natural, but neither is indifference to our partners' sex lives or tolerance for polyamory. In fact, for many people, especially those naively taking guidance from scientists and pundits without thinking deeply enough about these issues, polyamory can lead to devastating effects. One of the better accounts of the human heartbreak experience is a summary by the anthropologist and author Helen Fisher. Drawing largely from work by psychiatrists, Fisher surmises that there are two main stages associated with a dead and dying relationship, which is so often tied to a partner's infidelities. During the protest stage that occurs in the immediate aftermath of rejection, abandoned lovers, she says, are generally dedicated to winning their partner back. They obsessively dissect the relationship, trying to establish what went wrong, and they doggedly strategize about how to rekindle the romance. Disappointed lovers often make dramatic, humiliating, or even dangerous entrances into a beloved's home or place of work. Then they storm out, only to return and plead anew. They visit mutual haunts and shared friends, and they phone, email, and write letters, pleading, accusing, and/or trying to seduce their abandoner. At the neurobiological level, the protest stage is characterized by unusually heightened, even frantic activity of dopamine and norepinephrine receptors in the brain, which has the effect of pronounced alertness similar to what is found in young animals abandoned by their mothers. This impassioned protest stage, if it proves unsuccessful in reestablishing the romantic relationship, slowly disintegrates into the second stage of heartbreak, what Fisher refers to as resignation despair, in which the rejected party gives up all hope of ever getting back together. Drugged by sorrow, writes Fisher, most cry, lie in bed, stare into space, drink too much, or hole up and watch TV. At the level of the brain, overtaxed dopamine-making cells begin sputtering out, causing lethargy and depression. And in the saddest cases, this depression is linked to heart attacks or strokes, so people can quite literally die of a broken heart. So we may not be naturally monogamous as a species, but neither are we entirely naturally polygamous. It's depressing to even hear about, I realize, but for most people, those all-important chemicals eventually begin pulsating again when a new love affair begins. Let me note, however, that one of the more fascinating things about the resignation despair stage is the possibility that it actually serves an adaptive function that may help to salvage the doomed relationship, especially for an empathetic species such as our own. As I mentioned earlier, heartbreak is not easily experienced at either end, and when your actions have produced such a sad and lamentable reaction in another person, when you watch someone you care about, but no longer feel any real long-term or sexual desire to be with, suffer in such ways, it can be difficult to fully extricate yourself from a withered romance. If I had to guess, in the absence of any studies that I'm aware of to support this claim, I'd say that a considerable amount of genes have replicated in our species solely because, with our damnable social cognitive abilities, we just don't have the heart to break other people's hearts. Again, we may not be a sexually exclusive species, but we do form deep romantic attachments, and the emotional scaffolding on which these attachments are built is extraordinarily sensitive to our partner's sexual indiscretions. I also say this as a gay man who, according to mainstream evolutionary thinking, shouldn't be terribly concerned about his partner having sex with strangers. After all, it isn't as though he's going to get pregnant and cuckold me into raising another man's offspring. But if you'd explained that to me as I was screaming invectives at one of my partners following my discovery that he was cheating on me, curled up in the fetal position in the corner of my kitchen and rocking myself into self-pitying oblivion, or as I was vomiting my guts out over the toilet for much of the next 2 weeks, I would have nodded in rational Darwinian assent while still trembling like a wounded animal. In fact, sexual jealousy in homosexual relationships, especially with respect to gay men, is a place where polyamory chic meets with some significant theoretical problems. One of the most frequently cited findings in evolutionary psychology is the fact that men tend to become most jealous when their female partners have sex with other men, whereas women tend to get most jealous when their male partners show signs of what's called emotional infidelity, behaviors that indicate that the man may be interested in more than sex with another woman and has developed meaningful feelings for her, possibly signaling long-term plans. These aren't mutually exclusive types of jealousy, mind you, but instead they represent points along a continuum or spectrum of jealousy, emotional jealousy at one end and sexual jealousy at the other. Males and females simply tend to fall, on average, at different places along the way in terms of what triggers their highest levels of jealousy. This general sex difference makes sense from an evolutionary perspective. Prior to the era of DNA testing, which is of course when human brains evolved, men were extremely vulnerable to investing unwittingly in some other guy's genes, conveniently packaged in the form of children. By contrast, women, encumbered by the many physical demands of bearing and tending to young children, would have evolved to rely primarily on their male long-term partner to help them raise their offspring to reproductive age. Therefore, they'd have been at risk of having his attention and resources diverted to another woman and her offspring. So when it comes to homosexual affairs, writes the psychologist Brad Sagarin and his colleagues in Evolution and Human Behavior, a same-sex infidelity does not entail the asymmetrical threats of mistaken paternity and of resources being diverted to another woman's children, suggesting both that the sexes may be similar in their jealous responses and that such responses may be less intense than in the case of opposite-sex infidelities. In fact, in studies designed to test this basic hypothesis, the researchers indeed found that jealousy was less intense when straight participants were asked how they would feel, hypothetically, if their partners had a homosexual fling than if they were to become involved with someone from the opposite sex. Personally, I think the participants would have other things to worry about besides jealousy if their partners were on the down low, but these data clearly show that reproductive-related concerns indeed moderate feelings of jealousy in human romantic relationships. But the foregoing study actually highlights bisexual affairs, since the hypothetical cheating spouse is in a primary sexual relationship with someone of the opposite sex. By contrast, from the perspective of a same-sex partner in a long-term relationship, homosexual infidelity may elicit a different pattern of jealousy altogether. After all, as any gay person with a past knows, homosexual relationships certainly aren't without their fair share of this type of drama. Gay men may, in fact, be less distressed by sexual infidelity than are straight men, but there are meaningful individual differences in this regard. Still, I'm willing to speculate and say this, most of us certainly aren't completely okay with the idea of our partners having sex with whomever they please. Nor, I'd imagine, are most lesbians comfortable with their partners seeing other lesbians and developing close relationships with them. That is, emotional infidelity. Now, perhaps I'm in a minority in caring so much about my partner's same-sex behaviors, at least the ones not including me. When asked in a 2010 interview by a reporter for New York Magazine how he'd feel if his husband Terry cheated on him, the well-known sex columnist Dan Savage, for example, said that he would, quote, not give a shit, and that gay men are not psycho like straight people are, about sexual infidelity in their partners. I'm not so sure about that. Often we're just as psycho. In my case, I informed the sexual interloper that I would gladly emasculate him with a crisp pair of scissors if ever he made contact again with my partner. This was classically aggressive mate-guarding behavior as seen in straight men threatening their sexual rivals. Scaring off other men like this, most evolutionary theorists believe, is a preemptive tactic designed to thwart cuckoldry. Gay men, of course, are unusually vulnerable to HIV, and that's reason enough to become absolutely furious about our partners cheating behind one's back. But although they're often commingled, jealousy is distinct from anger. Also, the deadly scourge that is AIDS wasn't present in the ancestral past, so the threat of this disease could not have produced any special adaptive psychological defenses in gay men's brains. So how else could one explain sexual jealousy among gay men? It may actually be understood by some sort of pseudo-heterosexuality mindset, in which gay men's brains are just the same as straight men's brains in this regard, hypervigilant of being deceived into raising some other man's child. All this is to say that I reacted the way I did at my partner's cheating on me because, at an unconscious level, I didn't want my testicular honey getting impregnated by another man. I didn't consciously think of him as a woman, mind you. In fact, if I did, I assure you I wouldn't have been with him. But tell that to my gonads and my amygdala. I do wonder also whether these differences may be related to whether one is a top or a bottom, a subject we'll examine in the next essay. Signed, no longer woefully yours, yet in perpetually ready and melodramatic sorrow, your once and likely future heartbroken gay friend, J.B. Top scientists get to the bottom of gay male sex role preferences. It's my impression that many straight people believe that there are two types of gay men in this world, those who like to give and those who like to receive. No, I'm not referring to the relative generosity or gift-giving habits of homosexuals. Not exactly, anyway. Rather, the distinction concerns gay men's sexual role preferences when it comes to the act of anal intercourse. But like most aspects of human sexuality, it's not quite that simple. I'm very much aware that some listeners may think that this type of discussion isn't proper science. But the great thing about good science is that it's amoral and objective and doesn't cater to the court of public opinion. Data don't cringe. People do. Whether we're talking about a penis in a vagina or one in an anus, it's human behavior all the same. The ubiquity of homosexual behavior alone makes it fascinating. What's more, the study of self-labels in gay men has considerable applied value, such as its possible predictive capacity in tracking risky sexual behaviors and safe sex practices. P. people who derive more pleasure or perhaps suffer less anxiety or discomfort from acting as the insertive partner are referred to colloquially as tops, whereas those who have a clear preference for serving as the receptive partner are commonly known as bottoms. There are plenty of other descriptive slang terms for this gay-male dichotomy as well, some repeatable, pitchers versus catchers, active versus passive, dominant versus submissive, and others, well, not by a gentleman. In fact, survey studies have found that many gay men actually self-identify as versatile, which means that they have no strong preference for either the insertive or the receptive role. For a small minority, the distinction doesn't even apply, since some gay men lack any interest in anal sex and instead prefer different sexual activities. Still, other men refuse to self-label as tops, bottoms, versatiles, or even gay at all, despite their having frequent anal sex with gay men. These are the so-called men who have sex with men, or MSM, who often have heterosexual relations as well, and tend to see themselves as straight rather than bisexual. Several years ago, a team of scientists led by Trevor Hart at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention studied a group of 205 gay male participants. Among the group's major findings were these. First, self-labels are meaningfully correlated with actual sexual behaviors. That is to say, based on self-reports of their recent sexual histories, those who identify as tops are indeed more likely to act as the insertive partner, bottoms are more likely to be the receptive partner, and versatiles occupy an intermediate status in sex behavior. Second, compared with bottoms, tops are more frequently engaged in, or at least they acknowledge being attracted to, other insertive sexual behaviors. For example, tops also tend to be the more frequent insertive partner during oral intercourse. In fact, this finding of the generalizability of top-bottom self-labels to other types of sexual practices was also uncovered in a study showing that tops were more likely to be the insertive partner in everything from sex toy play to verbal abuse to urination play, also known as water sports. Next, tops were more likely than both bottoms and versatiles to reject a gay self-identity and to have had sex with a woman in the past 3 months. They also manifested higher internalized homophobia, essentially the degree of self-loathing linked to their homosexual desires. And finally, versatiles seem to enjoy better psychological health. Hart and his co-authors speculate that this may be due to their greater sexual sensation-seeking, lower erotophobia, which is a fear of sex, and greater comfort with a variety of roles and activities. One of the primary aims of this study was to determine if self-labels in gay men might shed light on the epidemic spread of the AIDS virus. In fact, self-labels failed to correlate with unprotected intercourse, and thus couldn't be used as a reliable predictor of condom use. Yet the authors make an excellent, potentially life-saving point. Although self-labels were not associated with unprotected intercourse, write the authors, tops who engaged in a greater proportion of insertive anal sex than other groups were also less likely to identify as gay. Non-gay identified MSM, again men who have sex with men, may have less contact with HIV prevention messages and may be less likely to be reached by HIV prevention programs than are gay identified men. Tops may be less likely to be recruited in venues frequented by gay men, and their greater internalized homophobia may result in greater denial of ever engaging in sex with other men. Tops also may be more likely to transmit HIV to women because of their greater likelihood of being behaviorally bisexual. Beyond these important health implications of the top-bottom versatile self-labels are a variety of other personality, social, and physical correlates. Some psychologists point out that prospective gay male couples might want to weigh this issue of sex role preferences seriously before committing to anything long-term. From a sexual point of view, there are obvious logistical problems of two tops or two bottoms being in a monogamous relationship. But since these sexual role preferences tend to reflect other behavioral traits, such as tops being more aggressive and assertive than bottoms, they write, such relationships also might be more likely to encounter conflict quicker than relationships between complementary self-labels. Another intriguing study was reported in the Archives of Sexual Behavior by the anthropologist Matthew McIntyre. McIntyre had 44 gay male members of Harvard University's Gay and Lesbian Alumni Group mail him clear photocopies of their right hand, along with a completed questionnaire on their occupation, sexual roles, and other measures of interest. This procedure allowed him to investigate possible correlations between such variables and the well-known 2D-4D effect, which I mentioned in my essay on gay men and navigational skills. Somewhat curiously, McIntyre discovered a small but statistically significant negative correlation between 2D-4D and sexual self-label. That is to say, at least in this small sample of gay Harvard alumni, those with the more masculinized 2D40 profile were in fact more likely to report being on the receiving end of anal intercourse and to demonstrate more feminine attitudes in general. Many questions about gay self-labels and their relation to development, social behavior, genes, and neurological substrates remain to be answered. Indeed, they remain to be asked. That many gay men go one step further and use secondary self-labels, such as service top and power bottom, a pairing in which the top is actually submissive to the bottom, reveals even further complexity. For the right scientist, there's a lifetime of hard work just waiting to be had. Is your child a pre-homosexual? Forecasting adult sexual orientation. There are signs, some would say omens, glimmering in certain children's demeanors that, probably ever since there were children, have caused parents' brows to crinkle with worry, precipitated forced conversations with nosy mothers-in-law, strained marriages, and ushered untold numbers into the deep covenant of sexual denial. We all know the stereotypes. An unusually light, delicate, effeminate air in a little boy's step, often coupled with solitary bookishness or a limp wrist, an interest in dolls, makeup, princesses, dresses, and a strong distaste for rough play with other boys. In little girls, there is the outwardly boyish stance, perhaps a penchant for tools, a lumbering gait, a square-jawed readiness for physical tussles with boys, an aversion to all the perfumed, delicate, lace trappings of femininity. So let's get down to brass tacks. It's what these behaviors signal to parents about their child's incipient sexuality that makes them so undesirable. These behavioral patterns are feared, loathed, and often spoken of directly as harbingers of adult homosexuality. However, it is only relatively recently that developmental scientists have conducted controlled studies with one clear aim in mind: to accurately identify the earliest and most reliable signs of adult homosexuality. In looking carefully at the childhoods of gay adults, researchers are finding an intriguing set of behavioral indicators that homosexuals seem to have in common. And, curiously enough, the age-old homophobic fears of many parents reflect some genuine predictive currency. In their technical writings, researchers in this area simply refer to pint-sized prospective gays and lesbians as pre-homosexual. This term isn't perfect. It manages to achieve an uncomfortable air of biological determinism and clinical interventionism simultaneously. But it is at least probably fairly accurate. Although not the first scientist to investigate the earliest antecedents of same-sex attraction, J. Michael Bailey, a psychologist, and the psychiatrist Kenneth Zucker published a seminal paper on childhood markers of homosexuality with their controversial article in Developmental Psychology in 1995. The explicit aim of this paper, according to the authors, was to review the evidence concerning the possible association between childhood sex-typed behavior and adult sexual orientation. So one thing to keep in mind is that this particular work isn't about identifying the causes of homosexuality per se, but instead about indexing the childhood correlates of same-sex attraction. In other words, nobody is disputing the likely genetic factors underlying adult homosexuality or the well-established prenatal influences. Instead, it is simply meant to index the non-erotic behavioral clues that best predict which children are most likely to be attracted, as adults, to those of the same sex and which are not. By sex-type behavior, Bailey and Zucker are referring to that long, now scientifically canonical list of innate sex differences in the behaviors of young males versus young females. In innumerable studies, scientists have documented that these sex differences are largely impervious to learning and found in every culture examined, even, some researchers believe, in youngsters of other primate species. Now, before that argumentative streak in you starts whipping up exceptions to the rule, obviously there is variance both between and within individual children, I hasten to add that it's only when comparing the aggregate data that sex differences leap into the stratosphere of statistical significance. The most salient among these differences are observed in the domain of play. Boys engage in what developmental psychologists refer to as rough and tumble play, which is pretty much exactly what it sounds like, whereas girls prefer the company of dolls to a knee in the ribs. In fact, toy interests are another key sex difference, with boys gravitating toward toy machine guns and monster trucks, and girls orienting toward baby dolls and hyper-feminized figurines. Young children of both sexes enjoy fantasy or pretend play, but the roles that the two sexes take on within the fantasy context are already clearly gender-segregated by as early as 2 years of age, with girls enacting the role of, say, cooing mothers, ballerinas, or fairy princesses, and boys strongly preferring more masculine characters, such as soldiers and superheroes. Not surprisingly, therefore, boys naturally select other boys for playmates, and girls would much rather play with other girls than with boys. So on the basis of some earlier, shakier research, along with a good dose of common sense, Bailey and Zucker hypothesized that homosexuals would show an inverted pattern of sex-typed childhood behaviors. Little boys preferring girls as playmates and infatuated with their mother's makeup kits, little girls strangely enamored with field hockey or professional wrestling, that sort of thing. Empirically, explained the authors, there are two ways to investigate the relation between sex-type behaviors and later sexual orientation. The first of these is to use a prospective method, in which young children displaying sex-atypical patterns are followed longitudinally into adolescence and early adulthood, such that the individual's sexual orientation can be assessed at reproductive maturity. Usually this is done by using something like the famous Kinsey scale, which involves a semi-structured clinical interview about sexual behavior and sexual fantasies to rate people on a scale of 0, exclusively heterosexual, to 6, exclusively homosexual. I'm a solid 6. Like Stephen Fry, I wanted to get out of a vagina at one point in my life, but ever since then I've never had the slightest interest in going back into one. Conducting prospective studies of this sort is not terribly practical, explained Bailey and Zucker, for several reasons. First, given that a relatively small proportion of the overall population is exclusively homosexual, a rather large number of pre-homosexuals are needed to obtain a sufficient sample size. And this would require a huge oversampling of children just in case a small subset turns out gay. Second, a longitudinal study tracking the sexuality of children into late adolescence takes time, around 16 years, so the prospective approach is very slow going. Finally, and perhaps the biggest problem with prospective homosexuality studies, not a lot of parents are likely to volunteer their children. Right or wrong, this is a sensitive topic, and usually it's only children who present significant sex-atypical behaviors, such as those with gender identity disorder, who are brought into clinics and whose cases are made available to researchers. For example, the psychologist Kelly Drummond and her colleagues interviewed 25 adult women who were referred by their parents for assessment at a mental health clinic when they were between 3 and 12 years of age. At the time, all of these girls had several diagnostic indicators of gender identity disorder. They might have strongly preferred male playmates, insisted on wearing boys' clothing, favored rough and tumble play over dolls and dress-up, stated that they would eventually grow a penis, or refused to urinate in a sitting position. As adults, however, only 12% of these women grew up to be gender dysphoric, the uncomfortable sense that one's biological sex does not match one's gender identity. Rather, the women's childhood histories were much more predictive of their adult sexual orientation. In fact, the researchers found that the odds of these women reporting a bisexual, homosexual orientation were up to 23 times higher than would normally occur in a general sample of young women. Not all tomboys become lesbians, of course, but these data do suggest that lesbians often have a history of cross-sex-type behaviors. And the same holds for gay men, according to Bailey and Zucker. They reveal that in retrospective studies, the second method used to examine the relation between childhood behavior and adult sexual orientation, in which adults simply answer questions about their childhoods, 89% of randomly sampled gay men recalled cross-sex-type childhood behaviors exceeding the heterosexual median. Some critics have questioned the general retrospective approach, arguing that participants' memories, those of both gay and straight individuals, may be distorted to fit with societal expectations and stereotypes about what gays and straights are like as children. But in a rather clever study published in Developmental Psychology, evidence from childhood home videos validated the retrospective method by having people blindly code child targets on the latter's sex-typical behaviors as shown on the screen. The authors found that, quote, those targets who, as adults, identified themselves as homosexual were judged to be gender nonconforming as children. Numerous studies have since replicated this general pattern of findings, all revealing a strong link between childhood deviations from gender role norms and adult sexual orientation. There is also evidence of a dosage effect. The more gender nonconforming characteristics there are in childhood, the more likely it is that a homosexual bisexual orientation will be present in adulthood. But, and perhaps you've been waiting for me to say this, there are several very important caveats to this body of work. Although gender atypical behavior in childhood is strongly correlated with adult homosexuality, it is still an imperfect correlation. Not all little boys who like to wear dresses grow up to be gay, nor do all little girls who despise dresses become lesbians. Many will be straight, and some, let's not forget, will be transsexuals. Speaking for myself, I was rather androgynous, showing a mosaic pattern of sex-typical and sex-atypical behaviors as a child. In spite of my parents' preferred theory that I was simply a young Casanova, Zucker and Bailey's findings may account for that old Polaroid snapshot in which 11 of the 13 other children at my 7th birthday party are little girls. But I also wasn't an overly effeminate child, was never bullied as a sissy, and by the time I was 10, was indistinguishably as annoying, uncouth, and wired as my close male peers. In fact, by age 13, I was deeply socialized into masculine norms. In this case, I took to middle school wrestling as a rather scrawny 80-pound 8th grader, and in so doing, I ironically became all too conscious indeed of my homosexual orientation. Cross-cultural data show, actually, that pre-homosexual boys are more attracted to solitary sports, such as swimming, cycling, and tennis, than they are to rougher contact sports, such as football and soccer. They're also less likely to be childhood bullies. Prospective gay males who adapt too rigidly to the perceived gender norms as they grow older may, in fact, become hyper-masculinized to such a degree that, as we've already seen, they also become dangerously homophobic in the process. In any event, I distinctly recall being with the girls on the monkey bars during second grade recess while the boys were in the field playing football and looking over at them thinking to myself how that was rather strange, why anyone would want to act that way. Another caveat is that researchers in this area readily concede that there are likely multiple and no doubt very complicated developmental routes to adult homosexuality. Heritable biological factors interact with environmental experiences to produce phenotypic outcomes. And this is no less true for sexual orientation than it is for any other within-population variable. Since the prospective and retrospective data discussed in the foregoing studies often reveal very early emerging traits in prehomosexuals, however, those children who show pronounced sex-atypical behaviors may have more of a genetic loading to their homosexuality, whereas gay adults who were sex-typical as children might trace their homosexuality more directly to particular childhood experiences. For example, in a rather stunning case of what we might call say-it-isn't-so science, science that produces data that rebel against popular, politically correct, or emotionally appealing sentiments, recent controversial findings in the Archives of Sexual Behavior hint that men, but not women, who were sexually abused as children, are significantly more likely than non-abused males to